Welcome to the Master Your Healthcare Career podcast, hosted by Dr. Anthony Stanowski. It can be hard to decide the next step to advance your career in healthcare. Join Dr. Anthony Stanowski, President and CEO, Commission on Accreditation of Healthcare Management Education, otherwise known as CAMHE, and longtime mentor in the field, as he interviews guests about the challenges and successes that shaped them into the leaders they are today. Whether you want to continue your education, make a change in your career, or learn what it takes to lead, this is the podcast for you. I am Melissa Cross, CAMHE Education Manager, and joining Anthony on today's podcast, we welcome Fred Hobby, former president and CEO of the Institute for Diversity in Health Management. Fred has more than 25 years of experience in senior leadership in hospital operations and administration. Fred's career includes service across three states and six hospital systems. Fred led the Institute into its second decade of service, developing tools and resources to promote, enhance, and implement diversity efforts in our nation's hospitals. On today's session, Fred discusses his history in civil rights, including marching with Dr. Martin Luther King, being a healthcare executive at Humana and with Greenville Hospital System, along with his passion to make a difference in healthcare. Fred goes on to discuss the importance for young people from underrepresented populations to be in healthcare management and how our hospital systems can better support them. Now here is your host, Dr. Anthony Stanowski, and special guest, Fred Hobby.
Well, Melissa, thank you very much for that introduction. And Fred, welcome to Master Your Healthcare Career. It's a real pleasure to have you on our show today.
Well, it's my pleasure.
I've known Fred for probably somewhere around 15 years. I'll never forget our initial meeting at the American Hospital Association annual meeting, Fred, where you and I got together. One of the things that we talked about was, you know, your career, my career, how we both kind of began in healthcare, and, you know, how that journey kind of took us to, you know, where we were at that time. You were the president of the American Hospital Association's Institute for Diversity. I was with Aramark. And it was a fascinating discussion that actually led to a fellowship program at Aramark. When we had that discussion, I think what was interesting was talking about your career at that time. And could you talk a little bit about, you know, how your career journey began and where it led you to where you are now?
Thank you. Yes. And it's quite an honor to be here. For the record, I'm 75 years old. I've been in healthcare 44 years, and this is my first podcast. So. I've been a first a lot of times, but this is the first podcast. You know, my journey in healthcare and this fight against disparities goes all the way back to my childhood. It's been a great journey, and some of it has possibly been influenced by my mother, who named me Frederick Douglass. So I kind of had some shoes to fill at birth. So since I was a teenager growing up in Kentucky during the 1960s, I was a regular participant in civil rights demonstrations and protests. I was particularly influenced by Martin Luther King, and I followed him around the country as a teenager. I demonstrated in Chicago, Detroit, my hometown, Louisville, Kentucky. Civil rights, a sense of justice and fairness, has always been important to me. As a result, when I got ready to go to college, I didn't choose a career path, but rather I wanted to make a difference. That was my lifelong goal. So I didn't say I want to be an engineer or architect or fire department chief. I just wanted to make a difference in people's lives by having some influence in improving equity and a sense of justice. So my career was actually born out of a passion to make a difference rather than focus on a career path. Once I went to college, I had a Black history teacher named Dr. Cheney. I was a sophomore, sort of undeclared major, and I was so impressed by his lectures on Black history. At that time, it was called African-American history. I said, man, that's what I want to do. I want to be a Black history teacher. So I finished Kentucky State, majoring in history and political science, and went on to Washington University, continued my passionate love for Black history and fairness, equity, and justice. And when I left When I graduated from WashU, St. Louis, I took a job. I said I wanted to be a teacher. I took a job at the University of Louisville, my hometown, and I was teaching race and ethnic relations and Black history courses. I did that for about 3 years. And the reason I'm going down this trail is I want our students to see how my initial goal was based on my passion for fairness and justice. That led me to a very high-level interest in minority history. That led me to my teaching career, which is what I said I wanted to do. But while I was teaching at the University of Louisville, as I said, Black history courses, the mayor of the city of Louisville approached me about some racial problems, tensions they were having in the city, and asked, he made the remark, well, we know you can teach this stuff. Can you practice it? Well, and that was a bit of a challenge, I guess. So I accepted his offer as the affirmative action director for the city of Louisville. So I left U of L and went to the city of Louisville. I stayed there for about 3 years. I wrote the city's affirmative action plan. It was the first municipal affirmative action plan in the country. It dealt with fire and police hiring and promotion disparities. That was our focus at that time. While I was at the University of Louisville, the president of U of L, University of Louisville General Hospital, approached me about coming there to work as a special assistant to the president because they had something like 13 EEOC complaints filed against the hospital. So I left the city and went to the hospital. While I was at the University of Louisville Hospital, this was in the 70s, Humana Inc. purchased the hospital. And they gave me a career option as the new owner. This was the first time a for-profit healthcare system had purchased a teaching hospital. Vice President of Human Resources invited me into his office and said, Fred, I'm going to give you an option. You can go through our two-year MHA equivalent, a two-year management training program, or you can join your colleagues on the unemployment line.
Well, it was an easy choice.
Yeah. I said, let me think about that for a second, you know, and it took about a second. I said, I'll take the master's program. So after I completed it, and look, by the way, there were only seven minorities in Humana Hospital Administration Division at the time, including me and one of my friends in the company during that period of time. I wasn't sure I was really welcome there, but I think they had some political responsibilities, at least publicly, to show that they were inclusive. So they recruited a couple of us to come into their management training program. I was eventually promoted to assistant administrator. I spent about 3 years in Virginia Beach, and then my healthcare career took off. So I had been a teacher, a college professor, a government employee, city government, and now I'm in healthcare in Virginia Beach. While I was there at Virginia Beach, I left. I went on to be a hospital COO, then a hospital CEO, and then I left Virginia and went to Greenville, South Carolina as a vice president for clinical services, lab, radiology, pharmacy, respiratory. I had all the revenue producing departments, which is unusual at that time because people like me usually got the ancillary departments, housekeeping, dietary, those kinds of things. But I had all the revenue producing departments while I was at Bayside. As I said, then I left, became a COO, I'm a CEO, and then I went to Greenville, South Carolina, where I took a vice president position. Patient care and clinical services. While I was at Greenville, we experienced an influx of limited English speaking patients. We didn't know what to do. There were Hispanic, mostly coming from South America, but geographically, Georgia, South Carolina, and there was another state that contiguous to those two, experienced a 360% increase in the Hispanic population. Greenville is a pretty conservative town. I think I can safely say folks didn't really welcome these new residents, these new immigrants. So the president came to me and said, Fred, we've got to do something about this disparity. that I'm afraid, says the president, that our non-English speaking patients are not getting the same quality of care as our English speaking patients. So he said, I had the largest division in the at Greenville Hospital System, the clinical division, more employees, big budget. He said, go off. Most of these patients are coming through your department, go off and get some kind of training and come back and help us figure out how to better serve these patients. So I went to Atlanta. I'm going to take a break here for a minute. I went to Atlanta to a school that was being run by a guy named Roosevelt Thomas, who at the time was the guru of diversity in corporate America. I spent a week there, 7 days in a classroom, learning about diversity. So I had formal training. That's another distinction I need to make, because today a lot of people are ending up in these diversity roles with no background, no formal. They just happen to be a minority and they get tapped on the shoulder to run the diversity program. And those outcomes have not been all that great. I came back and I wrote a plan for the hospital system called Managing Diversity for Organizational Performance. It wasn't long before our patients, our Hispanic, non-English speaking, German, French, et cetera, were bypassing other hospitals in the region to come to Greenville. So we were starting to make money off of this non-English speaking population. The other hospitals started taking note and eventually reached out to me to help them start their diversity programs.
Wow.
And my president, you know, we had an advantage, a market advantage, especially when some of the hospitals didn't reach out to these populations because they thought they were uninsured or underinsured, didn't speak English well, didn't want to deal with the issues. But when they learned that we were actually showing a profit from these populations, that's when they reached out to me. I couldn't handle these hospitals one at a time, so I approached Ken Shule, who at the time was the president of the South Carolina Hospital Association. And I said, Ken, let's set up a program where we can help all the hospitals in the state of South Carolina be better caregivers to these new immigrants and migrants and limited English-speaking patients. He agreed. We started the South Carolina Diversity Council, South Carolina Hospital Diversity Council, and that started to give me some statewide visibility on what I was doing at Greenville. I'll also mention, see how things just turn out. Because so many of these patients didn't speak English, I had to start a language services program, interpreters. And at the time, we were just using anybody on our staff, cooks, housekeepers, anybody to interpret for us when we were speaking to treating non-English speaking patients. Well, you know, when I think back on that, Anthony, that I had people from South American countries who themselves only had a sixth or eighth grade education. So how do you say in Spanish to someone, well, we're going to perform a minimally invasive cholecystectomy? Once we got our, I call it language services program, language services assistance, which is interpreters, started, then we started putting criteria in for how many years of education, your fluency in Spanish and English, et cetera, et cetera. And about 3 years into the program, the Department of Health and Human Services, Office of Minority Health, gave Greenville Hospital System a letter of commendation, as we were at that time the first and only hospital that met the LEP guidelines and the executive order of Clint to provide services in the languages preferred by our patients. So that was a national law, but I was fortunate enough to take it serious. But we had the first interpreter services program in the country as well. And I was the first diversity officer in healthcare.
Right. I mean, what comes to my mind as I kind of hear you kind of describe this pathway is you really kind of started out with your life mission, what you wanted to accomplish. And the opportunities became available to you, and you just you took advantage of the opportunities that were available, and you worked on completing your life mission on that part. It's fascinating.
Because I set a wide goal of making a difference. It didn't matter whether it was in healthcare, at the university, in the public sector. It didn't matter to me. But as you say, circumstances presented themselves or opportunities. I remember when I was first asked to leave Louisville, when I was working for Humana and this job came up with in Virginia Beach, I went to the president of the local urban league to get some advice. I don't want to leave my hometown, you know. I was teaching at the U of L. I was kind of a big thing, you know, homeboy does good. Now I'm working for Humana, big thing, first Black in the company, blah, blah, blah. I don't want to leave Louisville. And he said, Fred, you have to go where the opportunities are. What simple advice, but I took it, and it led me through three other states in terms of my career. But that, in a short description, is how I got into healthcare. It was almost accidental, if you will.
I think, you know, you kind of hit making a difference. And, you know, Fred, you made a difference in my life. I mean, when we first met and we talked about our journeys and you said to me, we talked about fellowship programs and how hospitals weren't offering them. Or you said to me, why doesn't Aramark do a fellowship program?
I remember that.
Remember that? And all I kept thinking in my head at that point is, what am I going to do? Get a couple students and watch them work, have them watch me work in a corporate office in Aramark's world headquarters in Philadelphia. Thought about it. And I said something to you at that time that probably was a little unusual. I said, I'm going to pray on it. And you might remember that.
I do.
Went back and talked to the chief growth officer at Aramark at the time, a guy named Jeff Connor. And he goes, well, tell me about these fellowships. What's it like? And described it to him. He comes back to me the next day and goes, Anthony, I got funding for four fellowships for you. And your job responsibility or your job review this year will be based on whether you get this fellowship program up and running. So given that it was my first month on the job, we got it up and running and we did it in partnership with the Institute for Diversity.
And it was very successful. And if you go back and look at those students, you should find what are they doing now? Because most of them are now CEOs and COOs running hospital systems or certainly hospitals. Yeah. It was a good investment. And you were fortunate enough, and I was fortunate enough, to be paired together to kind of architect such a program. So that was a blessing.
It was incredibly beneficial. And I think, you know, for me, the people at people at CAMI heard that there was this crazy guy in Philadelphia who was only taking CAMI accredited students in their fellowships. And that's how I got to be on the CAMI board and, you know, eventually, got this role. But Fred, if it weren't for you, and really, if it weren't for you and that discussion we had, I don't think I would be doing what I feel is my, you know, life's purpose right now. I don't know if I've ever formally thanked you for that, but I owe you a lot of thanks, my friend.
Well, I'll take that and a dozen roses.
I'll send them to you.
And your students should know that life provides twists and turns, and don't be so focused on, no, this is what I want to do. Be open-minded to opportunities because you never know where they're going to lead. I ended up spending 10 years as the president of the Institute for Diversity, the longest running. I was the third president. I wasn't the first. The other two are millionaires. They started their own diversity companies. Wally Johnson, multimillionaire, and Rupert Evans was the second president, and I was the third. But I was the longest. They were president for 2 or 3 years. I was president for 10. So thousands of young people through our summer enrichment program and our fellowships and me trying to promote diversity, equity, and inclusion in the healthcare industry brought me in contact with, I'll guess I could say, thousands of hospital executives, CEOs, COOs, CNOs, et cetera, who I still reach out today But we'll talk about that late when we get to what I'm doing now.
I think, Fred, your work on the Institute as president of the Institute for Diversity at that time was really kind of groundbreaking. I mean, you started a survey of hospital CEOs and what they were doing, and you really kind of created a benchmarking approach, kind of highlighted best practices within CEOs. I think, you know, the connections you made with corporate America and some of the larger health systems at the time were really, truly phenomenal.
Yeah, thank you. It was a passion. It was all about equity and justice. You know, that was what I wanted to pursue. And God gave me the opportunity to pursue it right on through 26 years of hospital administration. Because while I was working at these hospitals as the COO or the CEO, whatever, I was steadily pushing more inclusion. During those years, minorities working in healthcare or underprivileged, underrepresented groups were in the ancillary departments, housekeeping, dietary, security, et cetera. So everywhere I worked, I changed that model. I'm fortunate. I don't want to say I'm braggish. That's how, well, in short, that's how I got into it.
Well, Fred, I think, you know, one of the things that there's been a lot of changes in healthcare and a lot for the really kind of beneficial changes, still a long way to go and a lot more work to be done. But I think one of the things that you've kind of focused on is how do we get underrepresented populations to really take leadership roles in hospitals and health systems. And we've seen a lot of cases where that's occurred and has been very beneficial. I think, you know, Percy Allen down at West Baltimore and Bon Secours was probably a great example. But why is it important to have underrepresented populations in healthcare management?
The answer is relatively simple. We're still, these groups are still underrepresented. I can tell you that minority CEOs, Spanish, Indian, African-American, whatever, are about 9% of the CEO workforce. So we make up a very small, but it used to be 1%. When I started that benchmarking survey, it was 1 or 2% were minority executives. When I left, it was up to 9%. So I figured that's a good time to get to go.
An 800% improvement.
Yeah, but it took. But you know what I told people? I said, "Yeah, well, it wasn't that impressive because it took 10 years. If you average it out, it was like 1% growth per year. You know. So anyway, but it's important now because the demographic profile of our country is changing. It won't be long before minorities will be the majority population in America, and I know that's sort of threatening to some people, but here's what we need to know. I think as minorities become the majority, and that's projected to be around somewhere 2040, 2050, depends on immigration rates and birth rates, but somewhere in that 10-year period, minority, but we still have the greatest number of disparities in our health status and in our health care. So I would encourage your students to read a publication by the Institute of Medicine called Unequal Treatment, Confronting Racial and Ethnic Disparities in Healthcare. So if people think that every patient coming into the hospital gets the same quality of care, they are wrong. And it's been documented by this very prestigious physician and PhD research group called the Institute of Medicine. But so to answer your question, it's important because we need people in the hospitals, in the healthcare system, who come from these populations that for hundreds of years, literally hundreds of years, did not get quality care. If you look back in our country's history, the first places where African Americans could get healthcare was in the local jail. And then eventually the Red Cross back in the 40s started taking Black patients, whereas before Black patients would not be admitted to our private nor public hospitals. They had to get their care, as I say, in most cities, it was at the city jail. Not as a prisoner, but accident, whatever, they take them to the jail to get care. So today, as we move closer to majority status, we need people in these leadership roles who are going to be advocates for equity, inclusion, and fairness. Now, I don't want to insinuate that our white students and our white executives are not capable of that. But when we look at the history of inclusion in America, it hasn't been until recently, recently being the last 20 years or so, maybe 30, it hasn't been, inclusion has not been very impressive. So we need young people coming into healthcare now to make sure that these patients that we are privileged to take care of, regardless of race, ethnicity, gender, sexual orientation, et cetera, that we have people from those populations now at the executive table in these health systems to make sure that those patients and all other patients are treated equitably and fairly and get the same quality of care. That's why it's important.
One of the other reasons why I think it's important is I was watching a show. It was called For All Mankind. Mm. And it was an interesting show that really kind of talked about what if Russia was the first man on the moon instead of the United States, and then how kind of history kind of talked from there. And one of the stars of the show actually had a podcast about the show. And she was talking about African-American astronauts.
Yeah.
And one of the things that she was talking about was her parents always taught her that you can be whatever you want to be. You can be whatever you want to be. And the comment that she said was, you can't be what you don't see.
Right.
And that was an interesting kind of positioning around there in this. And I think when you have the leader of a hospital, the leader of a health system, be from an underrepresented population, serving that underrepresented population, it also does something for the young people in the community that I can be a leader. I can have a significant impact on the community.
Well, you know, you mentioned this name. When I was transferred by Humana from Louisville to Virginia Beach, I was in a supermarket near my hospital. I went there after work to buy groceries before I went to my apartment. And it was pretty homogeneous neighborhood. There was another Black guy in that supermarket. There were just two of us in there. And I was amazed to see him. His name was Percy Allen.
Oh.
And when we saw each other, you know, there was sort of a connection. So he came over to me, being my elder, and said, "Who are you?" And I said, "I'm Fred Hobby." "Well, what do you do, Fred?" "I'm a hospital administrator at Bayside Hospital right up the street." He said, "Well, are you a member of NASI, the National Association of Health Services Executives, NAHSE? I said, "What is NASI?" Well, make a long story short, I ended up creating the South Carolina chapter of NASI,
wow.
Served on the board of NASI twice, received their senior executive award in 90, I think. So from that conversation with Percy Allen, who is now deceased, bless his heart, bless his soul, that conversation about NASI made me look into it. And it was another opportunity that I had never heard of before. But I spent, since that meeting with him, I have been a member and a dues-paying member and a board member twice and so forth. And NASI has literally been a tool to further inform my career decisions. You know, what I learned from Percy, and Percy made a lot of money. He was a big CEO in Boston. I was a daring assistant administrator. I don't think I was making $60,000 at that time. He said, "Fred, it's not about the money. It's about helping other people."
Wow.
And boy, did that boom. And I was right in line with what I said from the beginning, that I wanted to make a difference. And it stuck with me. Percy was my role model to the day he died.
And Fred, I got to tell you, that's what Tim Campbell said to me with this role with CAMI, because I really didn't picture going to a small nonprofit at the time. And Tim said to me, Anthony, it's not about how much money you make. Are you doing what you love? And are you helping people? And it's an interesting, you know, that mentor yeah. relationship that yeah. really kind of makes yeah. a difference.
Yep. Yeah.
Fred, let me kind of go back. There was one part in your career where you were talking about language and people coming from South America who spoke Spanish or different languages. And how did you kind of, you know, make that connection there to ensure they had good care? And I think right now you're the chief diversity strategist and brand ambassador. I love that, brand ambassador at CultureLink. So could you tell us what CultureLink does?
Yes. CultureLink is a woman and minority owned DE&I consulting firm and language provider. We provide over two, so it's a language company in addition to a consulting firm. We provide over 200 languages 24 hours a day, both by providing hospitals, we're healthcare exclusive, by providing hospitals with interpreters on site. Interpreters by way of video remote systems and telephonic systems. Most of your people, students, will probably be familiar with interpretation services. And CultureLink has been around since 2006. When I retired from the American Hospital Association, its president, I mentioned it was a woman-owned business, and minority, Yolanda Robles, who is from the Dominican Republic, Hispanic, approached me about coming to work as a consultant for her company to help build their brand and to open doors with these thousands of healthcare executives I met while I was president of the Institute. And I said I would, because it was still furthering the same passion that I had of making sure patients got quality care. And if you've never worked in a hospital, if you've ever worked in a hospital, and you've seen nurses and doctors struggle to communicate with patients who don't speak English, it's not a fun thing to see. And these misinterpretations, which I had plenty of in my early days before we started training interpreters and getting them certified. I remember one of my colleagues, he trained interpreter, and Aqualingua was the name of his company. His name will come to me in a minute. And I approached him about training our employees at the Greenville Hospital System. And I said, we're using bilingual employees, but many of them don't even speak appropriate Spanish. How are they going to master medical terminology? And he said, Fred, you're right. You need to get them trained, because just because you have two hands doesn't mean you can play the piano. And just because you speak two languages doesn't mean you can be an interpreter. You have to be trained to be an interpreter. And as I said, eventually the Department of Health and Human Services sent us a letter that we were the only hospital system in the country in compliance with what was called the Limited English Proficiency Guidelines, LEP guidelines. His name will come to me, I hope. Well, but your question, did I answer your question?
Yeah, I think to me, it's kind of fascinating, because, you know, that was the issues you saw in Greenville, and you did the best with what you could do at the time with the right. skills and knowledge that were available to kind of help to ensure patients were getting the care they needed by creating interpreted services. And you think, even at that time, that was unusual, because a lot of times it'd be like, well, we'll just try to make it do with what we've got, right? And you fix that. And I think now fixing it from a systemic kind of point of view and making that services available and doing what you're doing with CultureLink, I think is fascinating. Well, let me, you know, I think we're kind of nearing the end of our podcast, but Fred,
we just got going.
I could talk to you for hours. I know we've had some long conversations and my wife would say to me, who are you talking to? I'd be like, Fred Hobby. I just like this guy. Fred, we're in really bizarre times, right? And I think we look at them as really hard times, but I think you've kind of worked through some pretty hard times yourself. Like you said, you marched with Dr. Martin Luther King, you know, a leader in the civil rights movement, you know, named a pioneer in diversity now by the Institute for Diversity, what would you say to the young people about looking at the times we're in now? What advice would you give to them?
Don't get discouraged. The job market is not as fluid as it used to be. The competition to get into hospital administration and move up. While we've seen a lot of fine examples of minorities, Asian, Hispanic, African-American, all kinds of folks actually now moving up the leadership ladder. But there's a lot of competition and there's only so many positions that go vacant and creating opportunities. So number one, keep pushing yourself, preparing yourself, so that when the opportunities come, you're ready to take advantage of them. My point is, don't get discouraged when those opportunities don't seem to be right on your doorstep. They will be there when it's time for you to have them. But rest assured, your time will come. So how do you get prepared? One of the ways is to go to a CAMI-accredited program. You know, in the last 10 or 15 years, all these colleges and universities have created all these online degree programs, and they're not accredited universities. They're affordable or whatever. But when you enter this very traditional industry called healthcare, you'll find that we are still sticking to the old processes, getting certified by the American ACHE, the American College of Healthcare Executives, going to a CAMI accredited program. Those are the things that help you be prepared for that opportunity when it comes. So, and then be open to opportunities that you weren't expecting or wanting, but if it gives you a chance to improve the life of other people, minorities and all people, at least give it a serious look. It might not pay the $400,000 you're looking for, but you know, how many people said money isn't everything? And then of course people say, well, it's fine. When you have it, you can say that. I said, you know, I was making nothing when I started. The careers, the salaries have just skyrocketed. Unfortunately, I wasn't in the business at the time, but I look back now on my career and all of the people who contact me, email me, et cetera, when they were students, undergraduate as well, and they went through our programs and so forth, and now they're running hospitals. And like you, Anthony, send me these notes of thank you. I'm so glad I had you in my life, et cetera. So it makes you feel good. It makes you feel good.
Yeah. And Fred, thank you for that. I think, you know, making a difference is really what you're saying to the students. And yeah, for you and your career, you've certainly made a difference for a lot of different people. Well, I think that's the end of our podcast today. And Fred, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate you being part of this special podcast today.
And if it goes well, invite me back for part two.
Okay, I will.
Thank you, Andrew. Take care.
Thank you for listening to the Master Your Healthcare Career Podcast, hosted by Dr. Anthony Stanowski, CAMI President and CEO. Subscribe, rate us, and leave a review. For more information, you can visit www.cami.org.